You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Innovative Metropolis, Part 2. We move forward with one further, a third panel, Adaptation and Renewal in Shanghai, Mexico City, and New York, followed by our second keynote, and following that, then a reception and respondents discussion. And you'll have other announcements about that, but when we conclude Dean Mostafavi's keynote, we will then move across the hall for that reception and respondents discussion. And I encourage everyone to keep those tweets, texts, and questions coming throughout the panel discussion and for the keynote, and as well for the reception and respondents discussion. But for now, I'll turn the proceedings over to our moderator for panel three, Michelle Napik. Michelle is the director of the Sustainable Environments Program for the CERDNA Foundation. Michelle.
Well, thank you. And I will say welcome again to the afternoon. This is no post-lunch coma session. This is adaptation and renewal. So again, yes, Michelle Napik from the CERDNA Foundation. And really, I just want to say a note about philanthropy and in the connection to all of this. CERDNA is really dedicated to creating just and sustainable communities through three interrelated programs: sustainable environments, strong local economies, and thriving cultures. And we also aim to tap into the promise of philanthropy by seeking and making bets on those social change passing gears. And a lot of that we heard this morning. We heard this thread of great emerging urban patterns, and it was punctuated by this notion of infrastructure accelerators, which is sort of music to my ears because my portfolio at CERDNA is framed around next generation infrastructure. We heard about sustainable design opportunities. We drilled down into innovative transportation solutions and built environment frontiers. And now we're going to pivot to the challenges of adaptation and renewal. And we know cities have been adapting to changes, social, economic, environmental, over many, many years. But where are we now? Right? We've got soaring energy consumption, storm surges and extreme weather events across the globe. We're sort of in uncertain political and global, complex global economic times. And so how are cities relating their past and current place in time to their futures? How are we adapting, and really what is urban design? So we've got this amazing cast of characters to help us go through this journey today. Valente Sousa is director of IQH, basically a hydraulic intelligence. He's an architect and urban designer. He's got extensive experience in public policy in Mexico City and beyond, really specializing in land use and water issues. And just in talking with him as we were preparing for this panel, I think he combines this layer of, well, multiple layers of public policy, innovative design, and community engagement. I think you said to me the landscape talks to you, and that the new variable in urban design is the environment, and his work is really proof that you can achieve sustainable design in public policy at a grand scale. And we've got Alex Washburn, who is the chief urban designer for New York City in the planning department. He's worked in the public and private sector. He served as a public works advisor to Senator Monahan, so he's earned his political stripes. And he brings this notion of innovative landscape architecture to New York, and it connects very powerfully with Plan NYC, which is really a set of programs and actions to help the city adapt to climate change. And I think I've read in interviews where you put a premium on techniques of landscape and an understanding of nature informing 21st century cities. So we look forward to hearing from you. And then Seng Kwan is an assistant professor of architecture at Washington University, and he teaches courses in architectural history and urban design. He's got enticing book titles and exhibit titles like architectural encounters with essence and form in modern China. And I think my favorite is Metabolism, the City of the Future. And the one in the works is On the Thresholds of Spacemaking, installation art by young Japanese architects. So in talking with Tseng, I really feel his connection between the edges of modern design and culture. So I think Valente said, as this panel started coming together, that they have lots in common, even though they haven't met. So now they've met. And so let's listen this afternoon to what they hold in common, to this sort of opening question to kick it off. And that's to have each of you describe a plan or project in Mexico City, New York, and Shanghai, respectively, that connects the goals of sustainable city and metropolitan economy. Valente, do you want to get us started?
Thank you. First, the Brookings and Washington University has done a tremendous job of putting together this panel, where the huge discussions of this century are mainly the topic. All cities have geographical contexts, and that's where I started to figure this out many years ago, about 30 years ago. The most of master planning, it's based on a ratio of population growth to services and utilities. And when I realized that was the equation, I said, well, this is like playing Monopoly. Doesn't make much sense if you don't put the occupation of land related to the landscape where this occupation takes place, that it has a geology, it has mountains, it has forests, it has aquifers, it has a number of issues which originally made the settlement of a central, of urban sprawl take place in the first place. And then we forgot about it because we became imbued in our cars, in our televisions, in our work, in taking the children to school. So we forgot the memory of space. And in a sense, this is a very compelling image that has allowed me to convince public officials that they have to redraw. It's like the drawing of where we live has been faded out, and I try to fade it in a cinematic fashion. So you start to understand that in the case of a very clear landscape like Mexico City Valley, it's in a high plateau valley, 6,000 feet above sea level, surrounded by volcanoes that were being born a million years ago, and that spewed ashes and alluvium over this great basin, and that's what created Mexico City with its theoretical lakes. They were not lakes, they were marshes. What happens is that as it was a closed space, it didn't have any source of water except for rainfall. It doesn't drain to the sea. It just stays there. It's a huge cup of water. So if you forget that, you start to live the city as a hell because it gets flooded all the time because there's no way out. So the major infrastructure, the most expensive infrastructure that Mexico City has, it's three pipe systems which are 30 feet in diameter to drain rainfall out of the city. So why we started to do this? Because we started to think of the city as a flooded area. Instead of saying, let's use the rain, percolate it, and then use that water for the livelihood of the city. So that's what we started to do 6 years ago, thanks to basically political leadership by the former mayor of Mexico City, Mr. Ebrard, and Marta Delgado, the Minister of the Environment. They had the vision and the commitment to say, we have to understand where we want to have the city within 40 years, and the first thing we have to start with is by recreating the landscape where we live. We cannot look against the landscape, we have to work with the landscape. So what Mexico City did, I don't know if I'm finding time, you tell me.
Why don't you, like...
Mexico City did was basically to protect the lands where we can have infiltration into the aquifer. which it would create new forest lands that were being eroded and taken over by landscape development, by real estate development. So we sequestered 4,000 hectares, which is about 7,000 acres of land, away from urban development, not like a ring road around London, but as polygons because of the geography that are taken out like mini forests within the city. And the percolation index of those areas is 1,000 times what it rains. So anything that would rain there would percolate. And that will give us autonomy of water forever, because it rains forever. It rains all the time. In the western side of Mexico City, it rains four times more than in the northern part of the valley. So it's just basic logic that you increase the forest areas there, and then you have a reasonable city that has a microclimate, has a response to the landscape, and you have new parks and new areas where a city can start to live and start to understand their city. Where the way we did this was to talk with the people living next to these ravines, and they participated in the master plans that protected these areas. We'll talk about it
back
further.
To that. Yeah, I think exactly. We'll come back to that. But that's a great illustration of how the public mindset was getting more connected to the physical geography and
That was a turning point.
That's an important piece. Alex, what do you say about New York City?
I guess first I'd like to say something globally. And it's great to be in a setting like this that Brookings can bring together, that the Sam Fox School can bring together, where a lot of really intelligent people think about a lot of really large-scale problems. But that's in a context of the clock ticking. And Ricky said it this morning, there are certain cities in this world that are growing very, very fast. As an average overall in the world, you know, we're getting 4 million people every 2 weeks. It's a city the size of Paris every 2 weeks. But, of course, it isn't Paris every 2 weeks. It's people coming to the edges of already established cities, cities that are underprepared with their infrastructure, underprepared with their understanding of how to manage their landscapes, underprepared for how to accommodate the surge in population. And then urban design is the tool that can change those cities. So I want to talk for a moment about what urban design is, because really it's one of the most powerful technologies we have, whether it is to achieve sustainability or social justice or anything else that relates to the form and function of cities. First thing to understand is that urban design does not design cities. Urban design designs the tools that build cities. So we have certain discrete, actionable products that we have to focus all our efforts on every day. These are rules, plans, or pilot projects. And they're used in a much larger context to affect change. An urban designer works at the confluence of politics, finance, and design. You can be the best designer in the world, but if you can't do it under the pressure of politics, under the economic demands, the quarterly demands of finance, you can't do urban design. So, who is an urban designer? Well, I'm an urban designer. I'm an architect. I draw very well. I wear black. But my role models are not architects. In New York City, where I'm the chief urban designer, my role models are actually three people. The first one is Frederick Law Olmsted. Mm-hmm. Okay? Olmsted was a landscape architect, and he could draw. But his life's work, which fostered a change in American cities across the country, was to provide New York City with an oasis, Central Park. And it's a fascinating history, but you know, when the commissioners in 1811 made a plan for New York, the great grid going up Manhattan, they didn't have Central Park. Their idea was if you wanted open space, you would go to the shores of these great rivers that we had, the East River, the Hudson, and there you could recreate. Well, the invention of the steam engine rendered that moot because now boats could tie up all along the shores of Manhattan. So by the 1850s, there was nowhere to go for peace and quiet and to enjoy nature, except maybe a cemetery. Olmsted changed all that, and he changed it with nature. He inserted nature into the heart of a metropolis and changed everything. My second hero from New York is Robert Moses. Moses started as a parks commissioner, and many of his early works, you know, we look on as just models of good government and making playgrounds for children, uncrowding neighborhoods of New York. Well, of course, through his very, very long career, where he very politically, astutely agglomerated titles to himself. He never resigned from everything. He started out as park commissioner, throw in the head of tunnels and bridges, throw in this. By the end of his career, I used to work for Senator Moynihan, which you mentioned. Senator Moynihan used to work for Governor Harriman. He was his briefcase carrier. And Moses worked with Harriman. I won't say worked for. And Senator Moynihan used to tell me of these meetings where they would go into a room, Moses would be there, and he would simply hand the governor a manila envelope with a list of projects written in pencil as to what he wanted funding for. The governor took it, and that was that. That was the extent of planning at the apogee of Moses' career. Well, my third and final hero is a woman who took down Moses, Jane Jacobs. And it was after the threat of Moses is building a highway through her neighborhood of Greenwich Village that she organized, confronted, and met him. And she was an advocate for the quality of public life in public space, for the fine grain of a neighborhood where she lived, her friends lived, her children grew up. And she was able to stop Moses. She didn't defeat him. I think that's important to understand. But she stopped him. And she set off a chain reaction that we operate under to this day, where there is a balance of top-down planning in New York and bottom-up planning. And you can see this echoed in our legal framework called the Uniform Land Use Review Process. It is a clock. When a project starts, it goes through with a sort of a conga line because it meanders through this 7-month period where community groups can have their say, borough presidents can have their say. And ultimately, nothing that comes into the process leaves just as it started, but it is kind of a living legacy of that Moses-Jacobs interaction. So I know we're limited for time here too, but every major project that happens in New York has to satisfy those three. My favorite recent project is the High Line, which, have you all been to the High Line?
Yeah.
Have you all seen the neighborhood around it, how it's grown? The High Line was $100 million of public funds. It's resulted in $2 billion of private investment. Moses would have been amazed that it was started by two local community guys, Josh and Rob, forming the Friends of the High Line. Jacobs would be amazed that government could have gotten it right, that we could have done a planning framework that would very carefully harness that economic development that occurred as a result of the public investment in the park and shape it into certain envelopes of buildings that would preserve the light and the air to the park and keep it a place of beauty throughout its time. And then finally, I think Olmsted would be very pleased with a walk down the High Line. It's like a ramble through Central Park, except it's 20 feet in the air. So just want to use that as a paradigm for what I think successful urban design has to be in the 21st century. You've got to have the quantity of Moses, the quality of Jacobs, and you have to do it with the technique of nature that Olmsted understood better than anyone. That's it.
I love that, Alex, and I love that you took us through the history of New York in terms of the scaffolding of urban design tools, and because we're about to turn to Song, who's actually an architectural historian. So that sounds like a good passing of the baton.
Thank you very much. So as an architectural historian, it would only be true to my métier for me to try to contextualize some of the things that's been happening to Shanghai's mobility, sustainability, and urban growth. in these historical terms, as some of the speakers this morning have mentioned, in terms of this DNA of the city or the culture of the city, generally sort of the sense of the longue durée. So the one image I'm allowed to show, I'm sorry, it's not bigger than it is a display of layers of the underlying structures of the city. One layer outlines the basic network of Shanghai's metro system, and the other layer, a series of colored dots, are the major urban nodes that have been actually instituted by the government of Shanghai as the sort of overarching strategy in terms of urban growth and expansion. So the urban structure suggested, represented by the color dots, actually we see on the screen, is supposed to suggest, you should take my word for it, a clear hierarchy. The 2001 master plan for the city of Shanghai calls for the so-called 1966 framework or regime, which stands for one center, nine new cities, 60 new towns, and 600 new villages. This hierarchical system has its origins in the pre-war plan for Shanghai, actually drawn just months after the end of World War II, by an international team of planners, engineers, and architects, many of whom were educated in Germany and the UK. And we obviously see this hierarchical structure reflecting some of the recent ideas coming in from Germany and the UK. For instance, the work of Walter Christaller, the urban geographer, and British planner Sir Patrick Abercrombie, who was, of course, the father of the Greenbelt and also the New Town movement. It was actually this model, first promulgated more than 60 years ago, that the government of Shanghai's successive regimes, despite change of governments, that it has continued to update and to promote as the main strategy to remedy the issues of congestion and density in what is obviously China's largest metropolitan area. The second historical artifact is the metro system itself. I'm calling it as a historical artifact even though it is not very old at all. The first line in Shanghai's vast network of subways opened not even 20 years ago. It opened in 1995. And in the next 13, 15 years, it has grown into a vast network of 13 lines, more than 300 stations, 510 kilometers of railway track. 8 million users use it on a daily basis, accounting for 43%, so almost half of the total movement in the city on a daily basis. And because of the financial crisis of 2008, an additional $30 billion U.S. has been put into further expansion of Shanghai's metro system, which will yield a virtual doubling of the network from here to almost 1,000 kilometer railway track by 2020. So far, so good. So when we look at the two artifacts together, layered one on top of other, a very different picture emerges. The metro network does obviously a very good job of connecting these various dots to one another. But you don't actually get the sense that there is a sort of correspondence to this sense of hierarchy, the 1966 framework. Shanghai's metro system is actually flat. Each line is essentially a duplication of one another, bisecting the metropolitan area from one end to the other, and with stations evenly spaced at regular intervals. In other words, Shanghai's transportation system, however heroic and commendable it is, surprisingly has not been working in a more complementary way to the city's vision of its urban structure. Not much attention has been given to the idea of mobility at the local level, the last mile, so to speak, connecting the train stations to the actual destinations themselves. I'm actually particularly drawn to the comment made by my colleague Oliver Schulze earlier this morning, this idea of slow transport versus fast transport, for instance, how to navigate the vast distances, again, the scale that we're talking about, the radius from the center of Shanghai to some of these outer outline new towns as 30, 40 miles, so that even at the faster of the commuter rail, it takes almost upwards of 45 minutes or an hour to get through the city. The kind of stratification of different modes of transportation, if it makes sense to have a clear correspondence between these two visions of the city.
Well, that's very interesting. It almost weaves together that notion of, was there a missing piece of the bottom up on that last connector mile piece versus the top down and some earlier comments. But I know, so let's go back to that notion of bottom up, top down. And Valente, you talked to me a little bit about the master planning process in Mexico City and how it really became to be something that was, here's a government vehicle, but it's really owned and driven by the people. Can you talk a little bit more about how that has come into being?
Yes, this has to do with how public policy is done in Mexico. You have laws that were implemented in the early 90s. It's called a federal law, the National Law of Environmental Impact. And that law, by its design, has obviously federal budgets attributed to what the law calls for. But no one had done any projects that would sequester or request that money from the federal government. So what we thought was we have to do workshops with the people that live in the surrounding areas of these ravines, which represent about 6,000 acres of land, in order for them to understand why we're doing the master plan and for them to put input into the master plan itself. So we did these large maps in relief. There are 1,000 to 3,000, and we projected the city on these ravines so people would know where they lived in that particular territory. And then we did a methodology of saying we are going to evaluate, give a value of how you invest over the years in the improvement of these ravines. No, so as it is an environmental value area, we had to give a value, and people would put pins on this territory, saying that we have waste disposal on this point. We have an erosion of land in this area. We have the loss of forest in this one, et cetera, et cetera. And that created a local database that is brought into a geographical information system. And we did from our end, as from my office, with hydrologists, geologists, botanists, ornithologists, a number of experts in earth sciences. We did multitasking and multidisciplinary workshops in order to bring in all the scientific data, put it together among the experts, and then crisscross it with the people that live in the territory, and that created basically the policies of the master plan. Once this master plan was finished, instead of giving it to the government, of course, it was given to the Ministry of the Environment, but politically speaking, we gave it to the people, to the organizations. So when their boroughs' presidents were elected, they would bring the master plans to the borough-elected officials and say, this is what you have to do for the next 3 years. And then the next one, and then the next one, because this is a 25-year plan. Once you have the master plan, going back to the legal guidelines of the LEGEPA, they can call in the representative elected to the Senate and to the House of Commons, no, or to the congressman, and say, we have this master plan. You can take out the monies that are already branded for these projects because we already have a project. No one had done that before. There was basically budgets that were never requested for, and they would go back to the Treasury year after year. And now we have like $30 million per year to invest on this, and that will bring the cost of bringing water into Mexico City at 0.7 cents per cubic meter instead of $3 per cubic meter, which is the cost of pumping the water now. So the turning around of how you do public policy was thanks to the implementation of workshops with the people and understanding where the city is. We have a geology that allows that. If you live in New York, which is basically granite, then you have a completely different system. You have the Croton system, which requires the forest around it to trickle down the water because there are no rivers. There has basically been trochelated, how you say, it's been compressed by the retiring ice 10,000 years ago, and that created the lakes of the Croton system. So you have a completely different policy to administer your water supply. But each geography has its own solutions. And that's basically what you have to understand. And the people who live in a particular territory, they have to rediscover where they live. And that's why we did these large scale maps in relief and then project them to understand where they lived in relation to the others.
And I also love the element that you shared with me, that there's a piece of that that's almost like a simulator. Like, so if you show an action to be taken and the investment to be made, it sort of shows out over time the impact of that. So I thought that was
correct.
Great as
that,
well. And I'm just
Actually an interesting point, because the same environmental law that is giving you funding in Mexico is inadvertently here in America keeping us from doing many projects. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so this isn't my area of expertise, but I see it in the timeline and in the tenuousness of major projects that I work on. That because of the requirement to get a finding of no significant impact from your projects, you open yourself up to a period of litigation which can often prove fatal to a project. I just want to bring this up, and here I have to state that this is my view personally, and I'm not saying the view of official policy of the city or any other branch of government that I've ever worked for. But we have to come from a background where we think of the environment as something to be protected from us. Instead, get to an environment where we think of the environment as something to be managed by us. You know, it goes both ways. I live in Red Hook, Brooklyn. Hurricane Sandy flooded my house. I love nature. I want to use it in any way I can. But I felt its effects. And I want to be able to undertake projects at the building scale, at the neighborhood scale, whose explicit purpose is to work with nature, countering certain of its forces that make my life more difficult, but enabling other ecologies to also grow. Essentially, it's to open up an era of change. And I go back to urban design as a tool of change. But part of that underlying it is a legal framework that has to adapt to the new needs of adaptation. Right? We have to come into an era where we manage nature as much as we protect it.
That's very interesting. I was actually just, I was going to ask you what your most fresh memory of the impacts of Sandy were, and I think you already answered that one, but translate that into your role in the planning department, and where do you take that now in that sense of adapting tools and finance and law, and what's the one thing, what's the one next thing you think you can do?
Okay, super complex problem. It really is. This sort of adapting our cities to climate change that has already occurred. In fact, it's probably worth a quick definition here of sustainability. We use that term very, very loosely. But in sustainability, on the ecological sense, there's mitigation, which is the efforts we do to reduce carbon outputs, which will hopefully help climate change in the future. But there's also adaptation, which are the measures we have to take today for changes that have already occurred. So making our buildings heat and cool more efficiently, that's mitigation. But doing something to protect my house from next year's storm, that's adaptation. So you can do that at three levels. You can do it at the building scale, where I could do something as simple as moving my electrical meters out of the basement and onto the first floor. As simple, have any of you tried to work with Con Edison? Just to do that simple task is incredibly difficult. We recently, just a couple weeks ago, suspended certain, through executive orders, certain aspects of zoning to allow people to raise their houses if they were rebuilding with a new measuring point, because we have limits on heights in different districts, just to figure out and to imagine the implications that would have is a huge process within a city. Now, that's just at the building scale. What about at the regional scale? Well, the streets, of course, is at a neighborhood scale. What can we do? Can we do anything with polders? Can we do anything with marshes? Let's say, for instance, mm-hmm. Red Hook, again, coastal city where we used to build ships in the 19th century. Wouldn't it be great if we could slow the lateral velocity of incoming waves by planting oyster beds and small reefs offshore? Mm-hmm. Do you know what the environmental impact statement for that looks like?
That's not pretty.
And then the big ticket items. What about floodgates? You know, the Thames has the Thames Barrage, which is in use constantly and saving London billions of pounds in protection that it gives. New York has a much more complex hydrology. But there may be a role for these large-scale, regional, almost national projects. They also have their own financing pathways, their own environmental impact statements, their own constituencies. If someone is protected from floods, does that mean someone else gets the water? How do you figure that out? So really, it eventually comes down to a form of leadership, whether it can come from the community level, like the High Line did, or whether it has to come from President Obama. Right. I don't know, but of the three forces, politics, finance, and design, politics is the most powerful.
That's a great point. I think I have learned when you ask a designer a question, you get layers of responses. I love that. It's rich. It's a rich fabric. But Valente, I think I was interrupting you at one point. You wanted to jump in.
On the contrary, I was interrupted. No, it's rather than managing nature, the approach, I think, even though it sounds poetic, we have to reestablish the conversation with nature. We have a monologue because nature is there, but conceptually we have to reestablish that conversation. I was invited to a TED conference, and as it was a TED conference, I said, okay. And I talked about that we had to rethink our understanding of how we go about life with the ethics of water. If we think as of a water drop, then we start to understand in personalizing what water does in the hydrological system, that the water has a right to fall on a forest, to trickle down into the marsh, to percolate into the rock, to run through a river without being asphyxiated by pollutants, etc., etc. So if you put your mind into that conversation, you start to have a completely different approach to how you deal with nature. And nature, by definition, is the greatest teacher because it's a complex system. And you mentioned the concept of adaptation. Nature is basically the most complex engineering system in the world. And if you understand what it does, I mean, it makes me cry. a tree...
Nature makes me cry sometimes.
A tree has this area of occupancy in a landscape. But it has hectares of foliar area. So that's what engineering is. And it, besides that, it transforms solar energy into sugars and structures of 200 tons. So that's engineering. And if we start to see how we can build roads, systems, etc., we can take a lot of lessons from nature, not in a poetic sense. We can look a lot on how that conversation can reestablish. And so if we allow nature to be within our cities, we can be living in a city that has densities like high-rise buildings in Shanghai, et cetera, et cetera, no? Or New York City.
Absolutely. And I want to take that one
quickly,
further
quickly, though, because I want to get some
scale.
Here.
Scale. Nature is scalable. Exactly. And even poetically, in terms of beauty, mm-hmm. you know, the beauty of a forest isn't compromised by the multiplicity of leaves. It's beautiful at all scales. But in a city, what we're finding now is that we can gain almost the same advantage as a new large park by simply planting a million new street trees.
Exactly.
So
mm-hmm.
add up together all the net positive effects of the 5-foot by 8-foot tree pits times a million, and you get the results you would have otherwise had to get by making a major land investment.
So that's a great point about adaptation. And
adaptation.
Design.
Nature is wonderfully scalable. Mm-hmm.
It's 2 trees per car in carbon sequestration. It's nothing.
Right.
2 trees per car per day. So, that's an equation.
That's a great point. So I love two other things here. The notion of crying because we get connected to something that's, this is driven by passion, you can tell, like how we live in our cities, how we want our cities to perform. It is about connecting mind and heart in so many ways. And Sung, I know you deal on sort of in design and culture, but I also heard you say something in our conversation that there's an issue of governance, that the management of cities need to be rethought. And I'm wondering if you could reflect on sort of that the management needs to be rethought, and we have to relate design to cultural expression.
Sure. So obviously things work a little bit differently than they do in New York City. Public consultation, to the extent that we're starting to see them in places like Shanghai, operate still, unfortunately, in a more perfunctory manner. Perhaps it's closer to the Robert Moses way of doing things than what's been happening more recently. In the case of Shanghai, this two-layer structure of the metro system versus the new town structure, one thing I just thought of is the first subway line in Shanghai opened in 1995. That was just about the same time when the housing sector in China, especially in Shanghai, became marketized. From dormitories for workers and work units in the Chinese planned economic system to the private market. 15 years may not be, 18 years may not be a very long time in the construction of subway networks. It is a fairly substantial period of time for the private housing market in Shanghai to emerge. Mm. And when we sort of contextualize this in still the Chinese land ownership system, where the state still is the sole owner of land and the largest, let's say, operator of land, has serious ramifications when we look at the distribution of the city where the housing stock is being constructed. And again, this issue of whether or not the new construction actually comports to the official vision of the city versus how they actually have evolved with the construction of the railway system. So for better or for worse, you know, looking at empirical evidence, we see Shanghai still following more or less this conic model with the city center, the densest, where it tapers off actually fairly dramatically toward the periphery, except for 2 or 3 isolated pockets where they had fairly long-standing centers of employment, for instance, university towns, steel plants, petrochemical plants. And these have been around for quite some time.
So. Right. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And so we've got maybe a little less than 15 minutes to go, and I do want to open it up to your questions for this panel, but I'm curious whether you have questions of each other, given the different perspectives that you've brought, even though you've got a lot in common.
It's not fair. We have time.
Yeah, we'll talk some more, but we should hear from you.
Yeah, yeah. Let's open it up for Q&A. We got somebody way in the back.
My question is, in planning in America, the existing land subdivision pattern has a huge impact on subsequent design once the land's platted. In China, you've gone through your first cycle here, but with the if you have one property owner, conceivably those property lines are much less tangible. They can be moved. And I'm wondering if that's going to open up greater opportunities for reuse and revisioning properties, unlike here where the existing property locks in very specific land uses.
Yes, a question about China. I know from I'll give you a New York answer, but
as far as I can tell, first of all, private land ownership, private owned usership, I should say, really has been only around for not even a generation. It's certainly within a generation of the lifespan of a building, a reinforced concrete building. And as far as I can tell, zoning codes in China operate in a very, very, actually, a different way than they do here in the U.S., where use and actually the building itself is prescribed to adhere to, at least on paper, in the most strict, much more stricter way than they are in the U.S. So, I think probably in the next 5-10 years, we will begin to see how the secondary market might emerge in the renewal and adaptation of these buildings, but it's still something we're not having a very clear picture of yet.
Too early to tell.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
The New York example I wanted to cite was the New York City block, 200 by 800. Okay. That was laid out 1811 was the decision. It's managed to have land uses and densities as diverse as within three blocks of each other, Empire State Building and a beautiful set of Chelsea Row houses. I think if there's any issue with the Chinese model, it's less perhaps the land platting than the road distancing and going to a kilometer grid with very wide roads. I think that's going to be the main hurdle to overcome. Because within any block, any city block, we found that you can change the zoning lot configuration and the platting of individual lots as long as it's within a block. So the size and configuration of your block is probably the most important decision a new city can make.
In terms of sustainability, which is the purpose of this conference, in the case of Mexico, you have the Ministry of Housing and Land Use, and the Ministry of the Environment. One of the big hurdles that we have is to blend the master plans of environmental planning with the land use, because land use is not urban planning. It's basically retail and land selling and speculation. So we are doing that. That's the next phase, to blend the kind of city we want within 20 years instead of being driven solely by land use. It's a huge discussion.
I know we had a question waiting in the back.
Hi, I'm Mary Ellen Hines, and I'm a geotechnical earthquake engineer. And geotechnical earthquake engineers always study Mexico City. And we are taught that Mexico City is sort of a bowl full of jelly, which is the jelly is the clay that fills the crater. So I'm delighted to hear that there are porous materials through which you can percolate water. I have two parts. One part is, did you have to sort of add to the porous materials so you had a place where you could percolate down to the aquifers? And learning from what you've learned so far, do you have any recommendations for the United States where we are facing an increasing challenge to deal with more frequent extreme storms that give us a lot of flood water and storm surge and increasing periods of drought? So we do not have a national plan to manage our water so we can take that flood water and now put it where we have our drought in an effective manner. So one, did you have to add to the percolation capability in Mexico City? And what recommendations do you have for the United States to manage its water resources?
A very kind and humbling question. In the case of the volcanic ring that surrounds Mexico City, by its geology, it's basically a very porous rock. We did the testing of soil with our geologist, and we have, as I said before, 1,000 times the capacity to infiltrate of whatever rains there. So it's just a matter of slowing down and amortizing the impact of the raindrop when it falls. It has to come into a layer of underforest to have time for it to trickle down. That's all we need to do. Initially, we're going to use geotextiles and a number of geomembranes to prevent the initial erosion, seeding it with local grasslands, which is Mulelgervia, which is a large grass that has this form and it has deep roots, and it will break the soil again for it to the first layer to become porous again, and then just under 20, 30 centimeters, you have the percolation is there. So that's why forests are so important. And in the case of the mid-tropical forest of Mexico, we have 400 varieties of conifers and a number of oaks. It's a very generous ecosystem. In the case of you cannot call it in the sense of the United States, but each region has its particular studies that have to be done, and its geology has its particular conditions of non-permeable, yes, permeable, volcanic, glacial, all sorts of conditions. You have to probably reestablish the conversation with nature, as I said before, and understand that it is the landscape that will tell you the way. It's not that you have to go back to how it was and become Yosemite Park all over the place. But you have to understand the borderlines between the urban sprawl and the beginning of the natural habitat. If you understand that frontier, then you'll do the master planning and regulations and planning in long term that will reestablish nature. Once you protect it, you can have the lions coming back again and the wildebeest coming back again. If you don't protect them and you're always regulating their extinction, they will go extinct. You need to give them breathing space, let's say, to those areas. What you were talking about, the oyster bays, to protect in sort of like a mangroves frontier in the coastline of eastern United States, is the only way probably to start to create a frontier that eventually will tell you if it's going to work or not. You cannot do large infrastructures in New York because you have a river coming down from one end, which is a fjord all the way up to West Point. And you have the sea coming from the other end. The tidal waves, you can't control them. It's impossible. So you have to move population inland, probably. You will. You cannot put them in sticks. Eventually, you'll do that. You'll start to make like a notilius city in the frontier that it starts to move backwards, backwards, backwards. And the new building of the coastline will have to be 5 miles, 10 miles inland. The new building, and the early building, it will take you 2-5 years more to get another event like Sandy. But you'll get it. We're all going to get it. I mean, the trend is like that. Mexico City is going to have more rain every year for the next 20 years. And the same is going to happen with the northern Atlantic.
It is a huge You'll have more challenge, moisture. Valente. We've got just a couple minutes, and I know we have a burning question.
Alex, a question about New York. I loved your redefinition of urban design as the design of tools, not of bollards, which I think is interesting, and most people would disagree. But I think you're right. Thinking of the future of the city and its sustainability at all levels, what have you and Amanda Burden been able to do which has promoted jobs as a designer, as a design chief? Because often that's sort of divided up, right? Right. Given that we're at Brookings, and Amy is going to ask this question anyway. I thought I'd get there first. But what do you think you've done which has changed the profile of the city's job market and where it happens?
Okay. Well, I have a slightly layered answer. The first one, where it happens. Made a very conscious decision in the strategic plan for the city to create new business districts outside of Manhattan. Remember, it's one of Mayor Bloomberg's biggest legacies, is that he has brought economic development around to all the boroughs. So we have now in various areas that we've rezoned to permit the sort of building that is needed for jobs. In Queens, in downtown Brooklyn, now we're even doing things like the it's going to be rather large, the Cornell University and Technion University plan for the high-tech campus. So they're very explicit decisions to locate areas of growth for jobs, support that with transportation, and with zoning, and with targeted public investments through the various agencies of the city. That's the technical approach. But there's also a qualitative approach. And that's one reason why urban design exists as a discipline within the Bloomberg administration. It's that Mayor Bloomberg believes cities compete on quality, on quality of life. And it's a global competition. So Amanda, I think, has very successfully put forward this notion that to improve the quality of public life, improve the quality of public space. And working with Jeanette and others, transportation.
When do the jobs come in?
Well, the jobs come in. We compete globally for many of those jobs. Many people come to New York because that's where they want to be. And being here, yes, they create jobs, they look for jobs. So the city, in other words, your city will have a hard time attracting jobs if it doesn't attract people. So its attractiveness to people is absolutely important. And then there are other Economic Development Corporation, others who work very specifically in a field that's not mine, but in working with business and the mechanics of understanding the various requirements in through taxation, through job sourcing, infrastructure for communications, et cetera. So the only point that I want to make is that it's a very conscious effort to attract and build on our jobs base, but it also has this side of it, which is to make the city more attractive globally. So, you know, we're hoping that many people who might otherwise go to London might come to New York. And similarly, Shanghai is in competition with New York for certain industries and certain people.
Well, this has been a terrific panel, and I love that a conversation about adaptation and renewal was really grounded in history and these layers of, you know, not for, like having this memory of space and reconnection as we look forward to renewal. So thank you all for that. And we're going to move into the last keynote of the afternoon about ecological urbanism. But before I bring up Bruce Lindsay, I just want to thank this terrific panel. And we're going to get unmiked, but Bruce is going to come up. And Bruce Lindsay is the E. Desmond Lee Professor for Community Collaboration and the Dean of the Graduate School of Architecture and Urban Design at Washington University.
Thank you very much, Michelle. And I have the distinct pleasure of introducing our speaker this afternoon. But before I do that, and along with my colleagues from St. Louis, I want to say how great it is to be here in Washington, D.C., and a part of a reconnection of sorts of both the Brookings Institution, but also our two cities of St. Louis and Washington, D.C. I also want to say hello to my colleagues and our students back home in St. Louis. We're streaming live, and we're very excited that they're listening in on today's amazing conversations. I also wanted to mention that in many ways this event here today started for us back in November with a university symposium on sustainable cities that was opened days after Sandy hit Lower Manhattan by Bill McKibben, and he gave us a very moving example of his work as an early writer for The New Yorker, traveling the subway stops of Lower Manhattan and seeing those photographs of that amazing event happen and reminding us that he had written a book on climate change 25 years ago, a pretty amazing, amazing event. That same week, a week later after the university symposium, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of our urban design program with a symposium entitled Urbanism, Sustainable Cities for One Planet. John and our colleagues and students welcomed urban designers and planners from all over the world to talk about some of the same things that we're talking about here today, and also celebrating the fact that our urban design program, one of the oldest in the country, has been educating students, and those people are out working around the world on some of the very topics that we're talking about today. And then, of course, here today in Brookings, and no one better to set the context for our discussions this afternoon than Dean Mohsin Mostafavi. Of course, Mohsin is the Dean of the Harvard University Graduate School of Design and the Alexander and Victoria Wiley Professor of Design. He's been a part of a number of institutions, including Dean at Cornell, and he was the chairman of the Architectural Association's School of Architecture in London, where he also studied architecture and undertook research on Counter-Reformation urban history at the universities of Essex and Cambridge. He's also taught at the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Cambridge, and the Frankfurt Academy of Fine Arts. As an esteemed member of the international architectural and urban design community, Mohsin is a trustee of the Van Allen Institute, serves on the steering committee of the Aga Khan Award for Architecture. He's chaired the North American jury of the Wholesome Foundation Awards for Sustainable Construction and has served on the design committee of the London Development Agency. He's also served as a jury member for the RIBA Gold Medal and Annie Spink Award and the Advisory Committee on Campus Planning of the Asian University for Women. And as we heard earlier today, he introduced Ricky to his wife, somewhere along the lines in that amazing history. Mohsin's talk today is entitled Ecological Urbanisms, and it's also the title of a book that he recently published. I would describe the book as being, in part, a set of radical interdisciplinary perspectives. As a member of the Sam Fox School of Visual Arts, I would also call it a treatise on the art of urbanism. Nearly 15 years ago now, Rem Koolhaas, in his project for the city, which originated at Harvard, in one of the early publications had an equation, and Valente was talking about an amazing equation of one car equals two trees. This equation was world equals city. And while it's not on the back of Mohsin's book, I think it could say for his book, city equals nature. And so it was wonderful to hear that come up in our previous conversation. It would, of course, be a double meaning in a sense, city equals nature. It's not only our nature, but the nature of Thoreau, which is the interrelationship of ourselves and our environment, and, as we've heard over and over again today, as importantly, each other. And it reminds us that that same openness that allows us to be sensitive to the inequities of the world allows us to perceive its beauties. And for that, I think Mohsin's book adds a fourth addition to the triple bottom line, which is the nurturing of our imaginations. So please join me in welcoming Mohsin to the podium.
Good afternoon. Many thanks to Dean Lindsay, to all our friends from WashU, Peter, Carmen. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to Ricky for the presentation this morning and for all the great things that have been said. Now, you know, this is the part of the afternoon when a lot of things have been said. The layers of kind of ideas are building on top of each other, and I think what I would like to do is really to focus more specifically on the role of the academy. What is the responsibility of the academy in this project of urbanization, especially because of this particular collaboration between the university and the Brookings? This morning, President Talbot spoke of the nature of the collaboration between Brookings and WashU by speaking of the arts, the beauty, the role of design more broadly, and really the connection of Brookings to the investigation of the sphere of social sciences more broadly, and then saying that urban design is the link. And I think Alex has now made another reference, and I think in a very helpful way has explained what urban design is. In the second part of his comments, he said that urban design, in the first part he said about the role of urban design as a set of tools. In the second part, he spoke of urban design as a discipline. Now, many people would not agree that urban design is a discipline. In my part of the world, people would say that urban design, like the concept of tools, is really about a certain set of practices. It's what you do. It's this combination of things that was mentioned. Now, Dean Lindsay now also mentioned that there was the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Urban Design Program at WashU. We had our 50th anniversary of the Urban Design Program at the GSD about 2 years ago. So I guess we beat WashU by about 2 years. But there have always been a lot of connections between the GSD and WashU. But the reason that I raise this is because it's only 52 years ago that the very first program in urban design in the nation was established at Harvard. So actually, urban design as an academic program of study is relatively young. So what did people do before then, before 52 years ago? Obviously, they made cities. They did. We know of many beautiful examples of planned cities, of organized cities, and so on. But it is only 52 years ago that we really had the notion of we need to study something which is to do with the design of cities. I happen to be fortunate enough to also have a department which is called the Department of Urban Planning and Design. And this department contains a program in planning and a program in urban design. And together, they make the Department of Urban Planning and Design. Planning, in the context of the United States, in some ways shares many of the ideas, the ethos, if you like, that the Brookings has. It deals with questions of policy. It's rooted in the social sciences. And in the United States, we actually have very few planning programs that are also connected with design. They are fundamentally rooted in policy programs. They are not project-based. Therefore, it's very important for us that the planning program at the GSD is indeed a project-based planning program. We design and deal with the imagining or the construction of cities. But what does it mean when you talk also about the putting together or the proximity of planning and urban design? In a way, the urban design that was created by José Luis Sert, who was then the dean of the Graduate School of Design, was precisely this idea of a program. It was not a department, and it was seen as something that a lot of architects and others did in terms of addressing the city precisely after the Second World War, when really the question of the reconstruction of the city became a critical part of what was needed from the academy. So today, I think during many of the conversations, there have been a lot of suggestions of what we have to do to our cities, to existing cities, but also in terms of how we begin to think about new cities. But I think from the perspective of the academy, since we are not an NGO, since we don't actually hold government positions, we try to have impact, but nevertheless our fundamental role is really in terms of the teaching, the construction of knowledge, the research, and the dissemination of that knowledge. from within the academy, we have the responsibility also to ask the question, what is urban design today? What is the relationship of urban design to planning? And how do you actually, within the context of the academy, construct the circumstances for people who are studying to be able to imagine and think about different kinds of cities? In other words, we have the responsibility not to reduce our tasks, our aspirations, to something which is really a certain set of technocratic practices related to the city, even though that's a very, very important thing. But the question of under what kind of circumstances you can imagine other possibilities becomes an important issue for the academy to answer. This morning, when Ricky was showing the transformation of the area around Thames Valley, which then became the Olympic Park, well, because we could see many years ago that there was nothing on that site, and it's really incredible to see the transformations that have happened in such a short period of time. I completely agree with this idea that, in fact, these things have been important, they have been radical, and they have actually produced very much many kind of livable environments. But the point is that the example of the kind of design that happens cannot be implemented by the bodies in some ways, cannot be forced by the bodies who commission the consultants, the architects, the practitioners who build these places. Those practices already exist within the sort of the firms that carry out and do this kind of work. And when we see the final results, it's important to note that the outcome of these results is still very much rooted in certain traditions of modernist planning. In other words, the concept of open space, of green, of residential buildings and things like that. It's a very specific lineage of urban design that we are the inheritors of. So I guess what I'd like to do is to say that it's really critical for us to speak about the way in which we can actually, from the perspective of the academy, think about alternative possibilities, kind of counter projects or projects that advance, if you like, the research, the findings, the proposals of modernist architects and planners. And this project of ecological urbanism was in a way of addressing that issue. It's not just to try and say that cities in the future should be ecological or should be sustainable. That's to be taken for granted. But it's asking the question, if we are going to think through the framework of ecological practices and think about cities, how does it act? How does it work as a catalyst in order for us to really imagine a different kind of city? Of course it's important for those cities to be more equitable. Of course it's important for those cities to have to utilize less energy and so on. But actually, is this city going to have a different environment? Is it going to have different shape? Are the forms of buildings going to be different and so on? So I think opening up that question, especially in the context of design education, and especially in the context of contemporary research universities, it then opens up the possibilities for collaboration, for working across different disciplines, which actually transcend the design discipline. And really, that's like the synopsis of the next, 15 or 20 minutes that I have left. The project of ecological urbanism, as was said, on one level has roots in other traditions. One, which has been, in a sense, mentioned briefly, is that at the end of the 16th century, we do find that there cities like Rome are constructing new ideas in terms of how to create an urban fabric, and that urban fabric is based on the idea of the connection of the different churches to each other to create, if you like, a kind of topography of Catholicism. But that topography of Catholicism, that notion of the churches as nodes and the connections as streets is something that's deeply rooted in landscape tradition. It's something that the person who was actually doing that was developing a garden and was really exploring the idea of how you make a garden with points, with obelisks, with nodal points, and the alleys that connected the parts of the park therefore become the exemplars for how you make a city. Literally, at the end of the 16th century, there was an idea of, in some ways, duplicating the city as a vision of a garden, as a vision of landscape. And we see the continuity of that much more explicitly when we look at places like the tradition of French landscape parks and see the correlations, for example, between Versailles and Paris, and the fact that on the one hand, Paris is a city of which is based on the notion of the utilization of military techniques, but at the same time, it's really the idea of a city that's based on a replication of landscape, of ideas that come from the formal French landscape tradition. So this correlation between landscape and urbanization has been in play basically since the latter part of the 16th century. And I think a group of people, including myself, for the last 10 or 15 years, have worked on a variety of different projects under the rubric of landscape urbanism. Landscape urbanism has been used to mean quite a few things, but one of the things in terms of the project that I was working on was really what is it that we can learn from the techniques and from the development of landscape as part of a series of methods for developing cities. It didn't mean that cities are parks. It meant that there are actually certain things that happen, for example, in the development of the agricultural territory, in the making of landscapes as technique that could be used for making cities. This is a much longer conversation and something that could be, you know, the topic of a lecture by itself. But I just want to say that felt that this particular project, in terms of the contemporary situation, has certain limitations because it focuses on tools, focuses on how techniques and so on, which are absolutely necessary. But I felt that the project of ecological urbanism really needs to be a broader project. It needs to be one that really addresses the question of the interrelationship between ecology and urbanization at a multiplicity of levels, economic, cultural, political, artistic, and so on. And therefore, some of these words that you see on the screen address, if you like, the tools or the modes of thinking or the sensibilities of ecological urbanism, which is the themes like the condition or the topic of anticipation, manners of collaboration, senses, the concepts of curation, productions of all sorts, interaction, mobilization, mobility, measurement of things, adaptation, incubation. And these became the titles, the thematics, the topics of investigation for the project. But many of these things also have to de facto refer to finding new ways of creating environments that produce, if you like, new kinds of terrains, new kinds of landscapes, because when we also discuss the concept of ecological urbanization, like the issue of endless city, it's really not just about cities as bounded cities. It's really about thinking about a territory that transcends the limitations or the limits of the city. It simultaneously incorporates the rural with the urban and so on. So part of the project of ecological urbanism is really the project of creating a new aesthetic practice, new modes of imagining. And here, for example, we have the case of salt fields, where these salt fields are not designed as a landscape. They're actually a productive landscape without any kind of predetermined, if you like, aesthetic value. But the actual construction of these salt fields produce an aesthetic condition. And so one of the things that I'm suggesting is that we actually need to try and create situations in our cities where what has been at times thought of only in terms of functionality, only in terms of usefulness, now begins to have other byproducts, which invariably must be seen as being pleasurable, aesthetic, and I think other people have made this comment earlier today. But this issue is not just to do with the territory. We're also building bigger and bigger buildings, where these buildings, for example, devoted to leisure and pleasure, are incorporating what normally would have been on the outside, would have been exterior, beaches, pleasure grounds, and so on and so forth, and actually internalizing that into what we might call the landscapes of the interior. So hold that thought about the idea of the open field and the idea of the interior that gets sort of big enough for it to be seen as landscape. And then, you know, we are facing a situation where this whole issue of resources, infrastructure, the waste that we produce becomes such an incredible part of our everyday life and says an enormous amount about us, about ourselves in terms of the conditions, the culture that we have through the production of garbage. The garbage of a culture is very much a sort of indicative of the values, if you like, of that, so that we can see the scale of the production of waste or garbage in a place like New York City. But at the same time, we can see that these questions of resources, and I mentioned the word infrastructure, can or maybe have other possibilities. The manner in which the salt that is used for snow removal becomes part and parcel of a curatorial practice. It's no longer just the function of actually using the salt in order to deal with the de-icing or cleaning of the street, but actually the degree to which something like the orchestration of where the salt comes from, where it's stored, how it's taken to many places, and so on and so forth, actually leaves many traces that can themselves be part of, if you like, an artistic or aesthetic practice. And therefore, it's not surprising to see, in the case of someone somewhere like Paris, with this particular project, which is the precursor to the High Line, it's a project called the Promenade Plantée, which actually used an existing disused railway line, which moves through the fabric of the city at a continuous datum, but the topography of the city changes, as indeed it does with the High Line to some degree. But here the shifts in terms of the changes in the sectional outline of the urban topography is quite dramatic, and therefore the Promenade Plantée is at one point many meters, many levels above ground, next to an adjacent window of an apartment building, and at another point it's on the ground floor of a park or a landscape. But the interesting thing about the Promenade Plantée, like the High Line, is precisely the fact that an element of infrastructure is also an element of the park and an element of urban pleasure. The other issue that I think is probably important to put on the table is that when we talk about urban design, in many ways, a lot of the time we're talking about the notion of middle scale, if you like. Urban design relies on one level on these concepts of processes and practices. On the other hand, urban design also relies on recollection. Recollection in the sense that urban design, if you look at urban design plans, they operate at a middle scale because what they do is that they're negotiating the space between the city and its architecture. This architecture is something that by the urban designer to some degree, and this may be a controversial thing to say, but to some degree is already given. It's a sort of pre-existing condition of architecture. It's, of course, not a design. It's not quite clear that that building will be precisely the building that has been placed on the map, on the site plan. But nevertheless, it is based on the designer's somehow reflections or recollections of a certain set of buildings that they might wish to have as part of that master plan. Therefore, this middle scale suggests that urban design on one level always deals with a pre-existing architecture, always deals with an architecture that has been, and in that sense, there is always a certain degree of nostalgia involved in these operations of urban design. So if we want to make urban design radically different, we really also have to address the question of scalar differentiation within urban design. The Japanese firm Atelier Bawa have worked on a variety of projects which could be seen as kind of micro-urbanism, really dealing with the concepts of small-scale elements of urban infrastructure. They have equally dealt with the rethinking or the reconfiguration of the Japanese house, where the section of the house, which by U.S. standards are minute, become extremely dense and extremely rich in terms of what they actually offer on the interior. Unfortunately, because of time, we can't get into the details of this. But take my word that this idea of scalar differentiation, of really dealing with both small-scale things and large-scale terrains of territories, in order to redefine the middle scale, is something that is really imperative for us to think about. And I could sort of relate that this also, for example, to the Mercedes-Benz building, or to the way in which when we talk about the question of ecological urbanism, we're also really thinking at a much more sensory, bodily level of city architecture and the interior, where the whole discussion of architecture shifts from the recollection of what we see as images, the legibility, the imageability of the city. And I'm emphasizing this because in the U.S., we have inherited now, after the modern traditions, a different tradition, if you like, which is the tradition of new urbanism, which is fundamentally based on this concept of imageability or legibility of the urban. Therefore, I think it's important or interesting to really think about the question of thermodynamics, of the thermal, of the environmental, also as something which is more to do with our tactile, sensory qualities of our bodies, and therefore we need to really spend more time thinking about interiors and the small scale as much as we think about the large scale, if we're thinking about ecological urbanization, if we're thinking about sustainable cities. And this is obviously something that led to, for example, this question of what about the inside? What do we think about the inside? We don't spend anything like enough time as architects really worrying about or thinking about interiors, even though many architects who within the academy are designing object buildings and large-scale buildings actually end up doing or spending a large part of their careers doing doing interiors. Therefore, I think there is something that we can learn from certain traditions, for example, again, of Japanese architectural practice. Here's the work of the Japanese architect Shinohara with some of his projects from the 60s and 70s that really worked, focused on the quality, the character of the interior. It's not so much about the design of the house as it is about the relationship between that design and really the kind of life that happens inside those houses. And anyone who's seen the work of the Japanese film director Yasujiro Ozu. Ozu was a director that made some beautiful, beautiful films. He focused very much on this idea of the filming, the idea of this, the interior, the inside as a setting. So these are some of the drawings that he was making for a film where you can see, for example, always this relationship between the figure, the room outside, the concept of threshold, the relationship of figures to each other, and so on and so forth. You might think maybe there is no, what is the relevance of cinema? What is the relevance of film? What is the relevance of Uzu to architecture? But I'd like to argue that, in fact, in such images, you immediately begin to implicate the body. You begin to implicate the user, the person who is actually benefiting or participating in some sense from the life, and therefore the kind of spaces or the quality of life that we have in our cities must be part of this project of how the urban designer or the architect is imagining the specificity of life that takes place in our cities. So more examples of how the Japanese are actually focusing in some ways. There are many architects all over the world who could be, but I'm just showing these images precisely to point out again the question of the necessity of scalar variation as part of the project of innovative metropolis, if you like. Despite all the enthusiasm, interest, the work that has happened on, for example, urban buildings, today we still really can't speak of too many significant examples of buildings that have combined the high rise with, for example, productive landscapes, with green, in a way that is functioning. So this is an incredible challenge. If we're going to have really dense urban environments, how do we begin to also bring that aspect of the productive landscape, if you like, inside, within the building? There is more and more work that's being done on how we can utilize energy from various sources, and companies like Ove Arup and others have really started looking at this notion of the green facade to mean literally a facade made of greens, and the Patrick Blanc uses the concept of the green in a much more sort of aesthetic fashion rather than in terms of the performative functional way in which Arup do it. But actually these kinds of topics and these sorts of issues of the interrelationship becomes relevant in terms of the manner of making buildings or making future cities. In the 1970s, there was an incredibly exciting French architect called Jean Renaudie. And Jean Renaudie built a series of very dense apartment buildings in Paris and in the south of France. This is a close-up of a building which is in a suburb of Paris called Ivry. And in Ivry, which is really a kind of very much a sort of working-class part of the city, he built this building where one of the aspirations of the project was to maximize the amount of outdoor space that each apartment building had. In other words, he didn't want to do a modernist apartment building where everyone got a notional balcony. He literally wanted to create a diversity of outdoor spaces for the citizens, each one of them different. It's quite a difficult task to realize, but if you visit this place today, you are absolutely amazed by the incredible quality of these different landscapes or gardens, literally private gardens that people have on their fifth, sixth, seventh floor apartment building. Therefore, this is also a project of creating a different kind of building, which is really utilizing landscape in a much more artificial way, if we can put it like this. It's not just about buildings in nature, but it's actually about the artificial incorporation of nature into the making of buildings. And I think earlier this idea of the balance with certain aspects of landscape came about. And so here are, for example, drawings done by Anu Mather and Dilip Dacuna that look at the floods, for example, the monsoon in Mumbai, and really the idea of the creation of new forms of spaces or landscapes that are in balance with that. These kinds of ideas, of course, in terms of going back to the categories of the ecological urbanism, connect to questions of mobility. And since we've heard from Ricky and others about that, I can go, you know, pass through this. But obviously, we need to think about this alternative modes of mobility. These are some examples that the late Bill Mitchell, who was a colleague of mine at Harvard and then later on at MIT, worked with some of his students in terms of creating new kinds of relationships between the automobile and urban infrastructure. And so constantly we are shifting from the small scale of things, scale of places, to the scale of territory and the scale of the region. Richard Foreman, the ecologist who is a professor in the Department of Landscape Architecture, has really done a lot of work on this idea of the study of regions, and really not to see cities solely in terms of their own defined areas, but really in terms of their connection to the bigger territory. Other colleagues have really looked at the whole concept of sea level rises and the manner in which we will need to think about this issue of Red Hook that Alex brought up more broadly across the world, where many, many, many new situations for building cities will need to be in relation to coastal areas. And therefore, we need a different kind of architecture, a different kind of urban environment that is much more malleable and porous and works with this question of the movement of water. Another set of interesting practices in terms of the multiple scales from the sort of invisible or intangible to the physical and tangible is really exemplified by the work of the Italian radical architect and urbanist Andrea Branzi. Branzi, working with a group of colleagues since the 60s, has pioneered a great number of ideas that really look at the possibilities of contemporary culture and technology in terms of the formation of new kinds of cities. For example, the role of network culture, the use of mobile phones, the impact of technology on urban areas, the idea of the agricultural territory through a series of projects which really look at the interface between agriculture and urbanization, which are also of really significant use when we think about cities like Detroit, where we have the density of the urban becoming more and more de-densified and actually finding more open spaces. How do you begin to bring the combination of agriculture and urbanization together? And of course, many of these ideas are rooted in an important project, which is called the Nonstop City from the 1960s. So my point is that we actually need to find new kinds of ideas, new sort of possibilities to think about the manner in which we think about the city and the making of the city. Some of our students recently have been developing these ideas through a series of projects called Over-Urbanism, where the relationship between the urban map or the site plan and landscape becomes so dense that you actually think about not just the making of buildings in relation to landscape, but actually a fusion of buildings and landscapes, just in order to be able to find new ways of thinking about the interrelationship between density and the artifice of nature. These ideas need to go beyond the scale and study of the interior to really the study of the surfaces of buildings, their qualities. This is a project that was done in terms of the study of the building skin and sort of responsive building skin. And really the question of the leisure and pleasure is something that is part of this project. Because of time, I'm just going to run through these slides without explaining too much. If we want, during, if there is any time afterwards, we can discuss any of them. But basically, this is to talk about the senses, the smell of the city, the visuality of the city, the role of music, the question of how we think about the city and its energy in different ways, the role of monuments or different kinds of monuments in our cities, the concepts of informal communities, and finally, really, what comes afterwards, which we don't have time to go into. These were some examples to really talk more specifically about the U.S. case of the connection between New York City and New Jersey. Many of you might recognize this as the beginning of The Sopranos, and I would love to discuss that with you, why I have these images of The Sopranos, but maybe we can discuss that later. And basically, my point is that after the discussion of ecological urbanism, this issue of the life that is lived in the cities becomes part and parcel of our material, of our project, of the way in which we think about the future of our cities through that understanding of life. Here are some beautiful photographs by Michael Wolff of Chicago, which is part of that conversation, and the city of Cardiff, which has a very different kind of Saturday night outlook, which we can talk about later, and the issue of politics. Finally, these are just some images to really emphasize the relation between the academy and the concept of dissemination of information. The ecological urbanism exhibition has gone, for example, here is how the people in Kuwait dealt with this. They took the images of the book and they enlarged it, and they created their own sort of book. And these are also the e-books an app of this, and, of course, the creation of other themes within the academy that build on these issues in order to create a kind of culture of addressing the urban. Maybe I will just stop here. Thank you.